Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So last week, I guess it was last weekend, when Jeff was getting ready to leave, I asked, just tell him I was appreciating him being here, and asked when he'd probably come back. He said, oh, next week. Well, it's quick. And he said, well, yeah, it's going to be a Friday night, the all-night sit, and the Saturday Dhamma talk. And I was really kind of impressed with his enthusiasm and the, you know, sort of really seeing that as a great opportunity to, you know, to come for a really short period of time to the monastery. You, just, you can come for a three-day weekend, make it a long weekend, and be able to participate in the, he was able to participate in the alms round, got to actually walk back with the monk from Ukiah, be here for the all-night sit and the chanting and Dhamma talk from Lumpur, and then be here today, participated in both the tea time sessions, just hearing Dhamma was frequently taught, discussed, and be here for meditation and another Dhamma talk. And it's just like, what a kind of a really nice attitude and opportunity. And I'm sure there are other people that have done that as well, not just Jeff, but this person I had the conversation with. Sometimes when I hear the look at the calendar and realize it's a Friday all-night sit, and it's sort of like, oh no, it's the dreaded Saturday Dhamma talk, we're all tired, most of us maybe gotten a couple hours of sleep, if that. This can be a kind of low energy period of time, Saturday night, and then knowing we'll probably have a work period tomorrow morning, so it can be kind of a negative mind state sometimes can arise from that. So it's just nice to see that really positive attitude. Been thinking about today what I would discuss tonight, and that's one of the themes that has been coming up in my mind, is sort of like how to raise our energy level. Here in a few days I'll be starting a little bit of traveling, starting off in Minnesota, and there's a meditation group there that always invites me to come whenever I'm in the Midwest, and they've got a full schedule for me. It's like I hit the ground running, and I think every night for four nights I'll have some sort of program or day long, and I'll be there for the Vesakha Puja. They'd asked a long time ago for a title for the calendar and things, and so I was just like, well, just be Vesakha Puja, so you could talk about say Buddhist ceremonies or holidays, kind of a topic in a meditation center. Even though I know the people, most of the people that attend the group, and it's a really good, all-encompassing kind of meditation center. It's not really the sort of belief that meditation is just sitting on the cushion. I know they do a lot more in terms of like study programs and a big emphasis on community life there as well, sort of bringing people together for potlucks and some sort of socials, where they can get to know each other at a deeper level. So they do have this sort of understanding that meditation isn't just sitting on the cushion. It's very similar to Lumpur's kind of talk last night, where Mahanama asked the question of the Buddha about, sort of mindfulness and concentration, and Ananda sort of answered him that it's much broader than that. To kind of narrow the question. So I was thinking of Vesakha Puja coming up and how to talk about that, or how to, for us living here in the community or people visiting the monastery, what's the significance of that, or how to hold these kind of Buddhist holidays, rituals. And also at the same time, just realizing that there's been several ordinations. Anagarika Anthony just had an ordination to become an Anagarika, and Suhajo just became a summoner, and I heard some chanting coming from the Barnes Room today. Sudhiro, practicing, probably early on chanting, learning, memorizing the full ordination to become a fully ordained bhikkhu, which will be happening in about a month's time. And so there's these rituals of people ordaining, and I know there's several people here tonight who have that intention or that desire to also sort of ordain. And that's a really important ritual ceremony that we do. And just sort of, thinking about this, the whole, how to hold these aspects of our life, there's actually many, many things that we do throughout the day that it can just become part of, that's just our life, we don't really kind of, think about it too much more, because it is what you do, and it can get kind of lost, or the significance of it becomes almost sort of insignificant, just becomes a habit. There was somebody last night in the house. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning. We're kind of interested in the bhikkhu rules, and I said, I'm sorry, this maybe isn't the right time to ask this question, but I'm reading these rules, and there's a really funny one here. It's like, is it true that monks can only bathe once every 2 weeks? And so I told somebody that this morning, and the Buddha didn't actually rescind the rule, but he made it very difficult, made it very easy to not give allowances around that, but it actually is a rule. And if you're living in the middle, living in the Ganges plain, that's still is a rule, but it's very easy to get around it, there's allowances. So we were talking about it at breakfast this morning, just that question, and he's like, yeah, when you first read the rules, there are certain things that just become kind of like some, strike people as kind of odd or kind of unusual the first time you sort of read the rules. And someone asked me, like, was there anything in particular for me? And I heard somebody else answer it actually the same way. So, like, there probably was at the beginning, but, after 15 years of sort of studying these rules, it's because pretty, they all seem to be pretty normal now. But I did remember, for mine, was just the size of the cabins. If you're building your own cabin, it was like that was one thing that kind of struck me in the early part. But the point I'm making is just that, as you do these sort of just customs and rituals, they can lose their meaning unless you actually take the time and effort to make them real. Just all the times that we bow to. Every time we say, come into a building, especially the shrine room or any place where there's a Buddha image, we're really trained to enter in and to bow to the Buddha image 3 times before, when we arrive and when we leave. So it's like even when you're at your cabin out in the forest, we're really trained. As soon as you get into your cabin, set your belongings down, and then bow to the shrine, Buddha image 3 times, and then maybe if you're only in the cabin for say 15 minutes, but you decide to go out and do walking meditation right away, to bow 3 more times to the Buddha image as you're leaving the cabin. And then when I do, when I'm on my walking path, I just hold my hands in Anjali and just sort of make that aspiration, 3 times sort of mentally, bowing to the walking path, and you're just doing a why, just sort of bending forward before I do the walking meditation, and then at the end doing the same thing. Then you go back in the cabin, you bow 3 more times. And I remember when I first started doing this practice at Wat Bonanichat when I was a layman, I didn't really quite understand the significance or why you were doing it. And I remember sort of one day counting how many times I was bowing, because it was just more of this thing of 1, 2, 3. Now it's time to eat, 1, 2, 3, now let's meditate, sort of, didn't have any meaning or significance to me coming from a very secular society upbringing. And so Yeah, but slowly, you know, sort of learning what the significance, and it started having more meaning for me. And I think it's one of the reasons I really decided to, of all the places that I could have chosen to ordain, one of the things that really drew me to Abaya Giri was, it was probably like maybe the first week I was here. I don't remember if it was Ajahn Pasano or Ajahn Amaro, but it was a evening puja, probably in the house, in the kitchen area. That's where the shrine room used to be. And one of the abbots was reaching over to light the candle, and you know, I was watching him, and he paused. And there was like, I could tell it was like he was thinking something, like he maybe needed to make an announcement to the community or something, like for just remembered something important. There was a long pause, and he turned around and said, "What are we doing? Like, why are we lighting these candles? What's the significance of this?" And then gave us just a little short, you know, sort of explanation of all the elements on the shrine, and just sort of, you know, going through the, you know, the candles of, you know, the symbolic imagery there is of the light, you know, coming into the world. So it's the light of wisdom, punya, and so it's like, you know, it's like one of our you know, highest aspirations is to be, you know, living a life that's you know, full of, you say, wisdom, compassion, you know, being awake, kind of like the same as the Buddha, you know, the it's what the Buddha means is to be awake, and so it's the significance of the candles, and then the flowers represent morality or the sila aspect. So it's the it's like when you're around somebody who's who has very strong practice of sila, and that they you know, there's a real safety that comes from living with somebody like that. And they say it's a, you know, there's a beautiful fragrance that comes from that. And you know, say metaphorically, or just, you know, just that that sense of safety that there's, you know, just a beautiful aspect of being around. And then the incense is the concentration. So it's the image I get is the, you know, when you light an incense stick and you're putting it there, just the very tip of the incense is glowing. And it's just like one pointed. It's not like the, say, the candles. If you stare at them too long, it might kind of hurt your eyes. And you know, very strong, really powerful. But that you know, the incense, you know, you can stare at the tip of it, or it's it's interesting too that it also sort of puts off a nice fragrance. Also, with the element of the flowers, there's different interpretations of, different traditions have actually different even elements on the shrine. But another aspect of the flowers is just the impermanence. You're sort of seeing that, you know, they're usually quite nice and beautiful, and we put them on the shrine. And Yom Yu did a wonderful job the last 3 months or 4 months of taking care of the shrines, and she can tell you how much effort and, you know, it takes to keep them looking healthy, keeping them smelling beautiful. But you know, if we really, you know, pay attention and we're watching the shrine, you know, you see how quickly the water grows stagnant, and the closer you're sitting to the shrine, you start noticing smells come from it, and it's a really great teaching on impermanence. Just the something that's beautiful today, just in a very short period of time, will go turn into compost. And then, so, you know, the key element of the shrine, of course, is the Buddha image. And again, that's say just the word Buddha is to be awake. So it's, you know, just reflecting on that. And in another aspect of the shrine that is really important is the just, I mean, keeping it beautiful and well looked after. So it's you know, every day, you know, somebody here will dust the shrine and make sure that the candles are in halfway decent shape, at least usable, and clean up all the candle wax and in dust, and so every day somebody here is you know, looking after the shrine, and it's a really beautiful sort of, you know, say image or metaphor as well. So it's like, you know, the Buddha, you know, being awake and being compassionate, and the teacher of you know, the way to awakening. It's like our highest aspiration, just to clean that every day, you know, to really pay attention to it, to make sure it's not covered in cobwebs, and it can be this sort of renewal of our every day, of our intention to live a skillful, wholesome life. So, you know, even at your cabin, you know, every day you should take the time to, you know, pay attention to it, and to, you know, dust the Buddha image, you know, every day, just to reconfirm your dedication to that, the principles that we're calling are the highest in our life. Then with the you know, with the bowing itself, you know, the physical gestures. Well, actually, I'll go back to, you know, to the shrine too. It's like, you know, keeping it really, really beautiful and neat. It's like just a couple of days ago, we've been really blessed, at least for the last 6 months, of just having just spectacular flower arrangements, you know, on the shrine, and it does something to the heart, you know, when you come in and the Buddha, the shrine is, you know, really well looked after, and you have all these fresh flowers. It just, you may not even notice it, but it can do something for the heart. It can lighten it, inspire it, bring joy and confidence. You know, just even knowing that, you know, other people, you know, value sort of, you know, making offerings to the shrine and making it look beautiful. You know, it's like, even if that's not, you know, maybe we prefer chanting, or we have other aspects that we like doing that are devotional, or, you know, helping the monastery in other ways. It's really beautiful to come in and just like, you know, really, somebody, you know, the monastery didn't buy any of anything that's on that shrine. You know, it's like everything there was freely donated and given. So you can look at it in terms of other people's desire for us actually to enjoy the shrine. You know, that this is a gift from somebody else to you. And but just the other day, it was like, I think just 2 or 3 days ago, I don't think there were any flowers on the shrine for like one day, or there was just I think a couple of little tiny of the orchids were on there, and that was it. And it made a huge difference in sort of the psyche. You know, when you came and you looked at it, it was just like something was barren, something was missing. It wasn't bad, it wasn't necessarily, wasn't wrong or anything, but it was you could see the difference in how, you know, what it would do to your heart. It's still beautiful because we have the Buddha the relics of Ajahn Mun and the Ajahn Khao on the shrine, and there's other elements there, picture of Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Sumedho, so there's candles and things. So it was still nice, but just you can see the difference between, you know, really well putting flowers on it, but then when it was barren, it had a different feeling to it. Then with the bowing, you know, it's a, like I say, you can do this, you just get into this mind state of, you know, okay, it's expected of me that when I come into the Dhamma hall, you know, it's like, you know, I better bow because I know if I don't, you know, someone's going to say something to me. You know, you can get kind of, it's a rule, you know, we have to do this. And so you just do it because it's expected of you. And that's, you know, I would say fair enough, but in that kind of, you know, attitude, it's we're missing the point. It's the real sort of aspect of, you know, even just having a shrine and taking care of it and doing the bowing and chanting and all these other, say, little ritual devices that we have throughout the day. You know, the main purpose for them is to quiet the mind. So it's like when you come in, it's really beautiful to have a particular style. You know, there's no really right or wrong way to bow. It's not like If you do it properly, then you'll become enlightened. You know, it's like if you do a certain number of them, you will be guaranteed stream entry. It doesn't work that way. So it really is there's a proper form that's basically just by the custom of whatever monastery you choose to be practicing in. So like when we go to the City of 10,000 Buddhas or to the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery, like when we're participating in their rituals, you know, we bow the way they bow. You know, we don't insist that, no, we're Theravada, so we do it our way, you know. About 2 weeks ago, Anthony and I were down at Berkeley, you know, for the first Tuesday, and we spent the night there, and then we attended their morning puja, and so the first 45 minutes of it was doing their chanting, and so we, you know, did the standing up and the, you know, sort of full body prostration, which is really difficult in our robes because they're not really designed for all that standing and going down to the ground and standing again, but we do that, and it seems quite beautiful to sort of, you know, do it the way they do it. But then it just happened to be on the Wednesday morning, they also do our chanting every Wednesday morning. They do the Ubayagiri Amravati chanting. And so when they did that, they actually do it exactly the same way we do it. So they got down on their haunches and bowed the more of a Theravada way, which I thought was really quite beautiful. And then honoring that. So... Yeah, so we did that chanting, but, you know, say Tibetans do this really, you know, full body prostration where they stretch their whole body out on the ground, and it's like, but, you know, just in and of itself, you know, doesn't matter how elegant or how exaggerated or, you know, say beautiful the bowing is, if just doing it for the sake of physical movement, it misses the point, and so the point is to still the mind, to give it this, a touch point, to come in to the shrine room or wherever you're coming from. It's like if you're going back to your cabin tonight, you know, you'll be making an effort to get back to your cabin, and you might be wanting to, you know, just go to sleep and be thinking about, you know, what you have to unpack or, you know, just whatever mind state you're going through. And so it's really good to, you just set everything aside and just compose the mind. You know, it's like you've entered into your dwelling, and you have to just to let whatever it is that you had been thinking about, not necessarily obsessing about, but just whatever you were engaged in mentally, and just, you know, setting that aside. And I gave a morning reflection a couple of days ago about, you know, peace. Actually turning towards that, you know, it's actually a choice that many times, you know, we actually do have that choice to notice the space around activities. So this, I really see that with bowing to the Buddha image. You know, I can just come in and just continue to choose to keep proliferating on whatever mental state I was in. Or I can choose to just for that period of time, just like, okay, just quiet the mind, just, you know, just even tell yourself, okay, you know, what I'm thinking is important. This is, I do need to address this, but, you know, just for the next 30 seconds, you know, I can just be quiet, and you know, and just and bow to the shrine in a really composed and beautiful way. And then say, so the thing I like about having, you know, a structure, a form, you have the, you know, I wouldn't say proper, but just the traditional way that, you would bow in an Ajahn Chah monastery. You know, so if you don't know that, you know, any of the monks here, Anagarikas, could even, you know, show you how to do that and give you instructions on how to do that. And, you know, to my mind, it's like looking at it in terms of, say, yeah, quieting the mind. But it also, you can look at sort of like, you know, you can learn a lot from your mind just by how you relate to it. Like you may actually have a lot of aversion to it, or a real, sometimes you may really have that intention, like, oh yeah, okay, I really can see the benefit of that, really quieting the mind, and I want to do that. But you might find someday you sort of have bowed to your shrine, and you're like, now was that two or was that three? You completely, just doing three bows, you don't even know, if you did three, because your mind was really distracted. And I remember quite a few years ago now, but I was, I don't know if I was angry or upset, or just my mind was really, really agitated for a period of time. And for like two or three days at tea time, I came in to the shrine room and was bowing. I was just exactly like that. I was like, was that two or three? I can't, I don't remember. And I was getting kind of embarrassed by it, even though I hadn't said anything to anybody. And then I came in one day and I bowed, and then I thought I'd done it three, but I wasn't 100% sure. And everybody in the room just burst out laughing. And it was just like, oh no, everybody knows. Everybody's watching and judging me. So yeah, and I asked somebody later what they were laughing about. It had, of course, nothing to do with, how many times I was bowing. But it was this real wake-up call to me that is sort of like, okay, yeah, you really need to slow down. It's like, just even that period of time, just use it to compose the mind. And so, kind of like, all the rituals that we do in terms of the things that can become really habitual, like the chanting. It's like it can be. We do have a kind of a short rotation of different chants, but especially like the evening chanting in English or in Pali, it's really easy just to go through the words and not to even know where you are in the chanting, or to even can be just a kind of a hollow procedure, because the mind can actually sort of get into this state where the next word and the next sentence of the chanting will sort of just pop into your mind, even when you get to know it well enough. Like it can be, the mind can be thinking about the morning work projects or whatever thing that's really interesting to you. You can actually be kind of thinking about that, and all of a sudden just this line of chanting pops into your head, so then you sort of say it. But then even as you're saying that, you're already thinking about what you're going to be cooking for the meal that day. So it takes an effort. So a lot of the ritual and these sort of ceremonial things, it does take this application of mind and turning the mind and actually wanting to use it in a way. And say the best way to look at it, or one of the best ways to look at it, is to use it to still the mind, to actually sort of give it the structure and give it the permission to just to set aside the habits and the normal tendencies of the mind. Then with bigger sort of things like ceremonies and the holidays. The Vaisakha Puja that's coming up commemorates the Buddha's all the sort of significant events that really happened in his life. Is the birth of the Buddha, his enlightenment, and his passing away, all happened by the stories on a full moon in the month of May, in the month of Vaisakha, and so they all happened on that particular day. And so it's known as the Buddha Day. And when I was, for the talk I'm going to give in Minnesota, I was just sort of contemplating what I don't really want to get into, like the story of the Buddha's of Vaisakha. But again, it's like, but how to use it, kind of like what I'm talking about tonight, how to use these rituals and ceremonies, skillfully. And so with ceremonies like that, it's, again, like all the different aspects of it, the chanting, the bowing, the shrine, you know, all of that. We can use that to still the mind. There's also an element of that I really find beautiful around these Buddhist like holidays is just the people coming to the monastery, you know, all the just seeing the faith and creating a community, people wanting to come so it's this it can bring up a lot of joy, it was interesting that last night in Ajahn Pasano's Dhamma talk, he was brought up, say, Mahanama, approaching the Buddha with a question, and then around this sort of theme of how to use these ceremonies, sort of skillfully. I remembered last year, I think we were coming back from the trip to Yosemite. We listened to the series of Upasaka days on brightening the mind that Ajahn Pasano, Ajahn Yatiko, and Krunodamo had led, so I started listening to those, the whole structure that they had used for that of brightening the mind was the ten the anusatis, the ten recollections, which start with the recollection of the Buddha. So that's very much what Vaisakha Puja is about, this sort of recollection of the Buddha, and then that's the first part of the chanting that we did this morning. Now let's chant the recollection of the Buddha, and then recollection of the Dhamma and recollection of the Sangha. Those are the first three of those. And then I'll probably forget the entire list, but then it's looking at sila, looking at contemplation recollections of generosity, looking at recollections of the body, kaya anusati, and then there's anapanasati, looking at recollection of the breath meditation. So these are all very common meditation themes. There's also maranasati, the contemplation of death. And then an interesting one that Ajahn Yatiko kind of tackled. I can't remember exactly how he talked about it, but it was deva nusati, so contemplations of the deva realms, or devas in general. And then the last one, there's really not a whole lot. I think there's probably much more in the Visuddhimagga, is where I think it's the references that I saw have gone to, but it's recollections of peace. And so that kind of came up after my morning reflection too, just sort of using peace as a recollection. So that's actually one of the ten recollections. And what Lumpur was really stressing during that Upasaka day of teaching is that all of those are, well, actually, as you can, just going through the list mentally, you can see that there actually are different purposes for each of the different ones, or most of them are kind of categorized together, but there are some that are more towards raising urgency, samvega, in our practice, sort of especially the contemplations of death, but most of them are more geared towards this bringing up joy, bringing up an energy in our practice. So this morning I just had the idea to just sort of look up in the Anguttara Nikaya the Anusati, and it interestingly sent me to the Book of Sixes, which is it was a shorter version of those ten, but it turns out it was a sutta that Mahanama approached the Buddha and was asking him. I think the question was more, it's like, for someone who is an enlightened being, it's like, where does their mind sort of frequent? Like, what is it that they kind of do with their minds? And then it was interesting that the Buddha went through six of those. It was the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, I think probably the body, the breath, I forget which one of those ten was the last one, but in all of those, the Buddha said, basically the reason that you would take on those, and I would say it's probably for the same for the other 10, is that when you do that, when you are bringing the mind towards that theme of contemplation, so it's like, say, the Buddha, basically at that point you're not letting the mind get involved in greed, hatred, and delusion. So it's a you're raising the energy of preventing the mind from going into a negative state, or if a negative state has arisen, you're applying a method to overcome that, or if a wholesome mind state has arisen, or one hasn't, then you're raising up a wholesome image, and if one does arise, then you're learning how to maintain it and sustain it. So it's this the right efforts, and then the Buddha points out that when you do that, when the mind is established, or you find confidence in any of these sort of wholesome contemplations, then he says the mind becomes, like, I think he says, straight. The mind becomes sort of going in a positive direction, so it's a straight mind. And then the results of that, he goes through this list of joy is the first thing when the mind is fixed and established in wholesome activity. Then there's this joy arises, and then from the joy comes I forget exactly the order, but it would be something like piti, the rapture, sort of a very physical and mental, more energetic sort of feeling comes into the body, and with that, then it's like tranquility, and then like the sukha, the happiness that comes from that. And then that leads to concentration. When a mind is very energized, it's gone through sort of the energizing of the pitti and reaches these states of happiness and tranquility, then the mind just naturally will go into concentration. So I think I think Lumpur was talking about this last night, and is that meditation, we can think of it as in terms of or just even the whole spiritual practices. It's like, I need to meditate, I need to put forth this effort to calm the mind, I need to try to be more concentrated. But looking at it in that aspect of looking at these 10 anusatis, is the purpose is to it's actually using the mind in a way that's skillful and wholesome, that the mind finds attractive. Or I think it's interesting that there are these 10, so it's not like the Buddha doesn't say you have to contemplate him to be happy. It's like, no, there's also the Dhamma, the teachings, or the some people really find very cooling the death contemplations, or the contemplations of peace. There's all these different ways that you can approach it, and finding one that really connects with you, and then when you do that, then there is this given a few talks about the idipadas, when there's desire, when the mind really is interested in a subject, it will really pick it up. And I'm sure most of you've kind of heard me talk about my experiments with painting recently. It's like, when I'm really doing that, I'm just totally shocking to me that I'm getting by on about 4 hours of sleep, and then when I don't paint, it's like my body almost completely crashes, and it's like it needs a lot more than that. So it's when I am doing that, when the mind is really really engaged in that aspect, the body just really doesn't need that much sleep. And so I can really see that this finding skillful ways to bring up devotion, to bring up to get the mind to contemplate. And then the natural consequences of that would be the developing of stronger mindfulness and concentration. So it's like if we, you know, like if we just are approaching it from the other direction of like, you know, okay, I want to be concentrated, so I have to, you know, have to, you know, stop thinking and, you know, just putting forth all this effort on the meditation cushion. And if it, you know, it's one of the things I kind of always notice about Lumpur's teachings is, you know, it's paying attention to the results. So it's like, you know, definitely sitting in meditation and putting forth effort in that way is not a bad thing, unless if you're doing it, it makes the mind really dry, really, you know, some people can be quite resistant to it, or they can lose faith, they can lose confidence in themselves if they, you know, are trying to force a meditation subject to work and it doesn't. I was actually just listening to a talk last night of Ajahn Dunn, and you know, he was saying the same thing, like, you know, he put so much emphasis on his teachings of like asubha and body contemplations, and I think he was saying, you know, it's like, you know, that's kind of the way he practices, and he says, you know, but if you start doing that and it does bring up aversion and the mind gets scared or, you know, turns away from it, then you need to back off. You need to do a different practice to make the mind calm and peaceful, and then come back to it. You know, not to drop it and say that it's not the, I'll never do that again. But it's to, you know, really constantly do this application of the mind to, you know, bringing it towards an object skillfully, and then paying attention to the results, you know, this evaluation, and then, you know, seeing if it does bring you to any states of calm, any states of peace. And then if it does, then it's a, you know, I had this imagery of, you know, sort of growing up from Indiana. It's just like, so it was like, you know, the first time you shoot a basketball, and, you know, it's like, it takes maybe a long time to get it to go into the hoop. But, you know, once you've got it to go through the hoop, it's like, you don't stop. You know, it's like, you know, it's okay, I've mastered that. And maybe a lot of people probably do. But, you know, if you want to be a really good basketball player, it's like, you know, you have to keep coming back to it. You have to keep learning, you know, how to do it in different situations, to actually master it. It's, you have to come back to it. So it's, you know, initially though, you do have to learn how to quiet the mind, how to make it peaceful. And then from there, it's like, you know, then it can become fun, because it's like, okay, you know, you've seen the results of it, you've seen the benefits, and then it kind of becomes like an investigation of trying to figure out, you know, under different circumstances and situations, you know, how to achieve a similar state, or, you know, maybe under different conditions that state of peace actually might look completely different. And so it's just keeping this open mind and investigating. I guess, and then in sort of closing, again with sort of ceremonies and rituals, you know, sort of looking at the number of, say, ordinations that will probably be happening in the next while. It's a, you know, looking at those in the same light, that it's, you know, it's really beautiful. That that's another reason that I'm really appreciative of the fact that I ordained here. I didn't know that was going to be a part of it, but just the care and attention that Ajahn Pasano gives to the ordinations. You know, it's like, I don't know how many dozens probably of, you know, bhikkhu ordinations that I've been to, and I always look forward to them, you know, not just because somebody else is going to be sort of, you know, becoming a bhikkhu or a samanera or an anagarika, but just the it's just this fresh reminder of, you know, like why we've ordained, and this sort of beautiful explanation, especially to the families, you know, that are coming and are probably, you know, not quite 100% convinced that this is the right thing for their son or their daughter to be doing, and just the, you know, the say gentle, but beautiful teachings that Lumpur gives. And it's like I was listening to a talk recently of Ajahn Viradamo, and he said, we could just sort of say, someone wants to ordain, and it's like, okay, great, mate, here's a white robe, you're ordained, but it wouldn't mean anything, it would just be this, I guess there's a saying in Thailand that, sort of easy ordained, easy disrobe. And so it's this sort of, really just seeing these ordinations as a really great introduction and explanation into we've had an aspiration or a desire, something that led us into the robes, led us to the monastery, and just to see that ordination is, it's a very significant sort of step. It's like I always sort of think of it or see it kind of in terms of it's almost like a marriage. It's like you're joining into a community, taking the Ajahn Pasno on as a teacher and everybody else here ordained and the lay people who support it, like you're actually sort of committing to be of service to them and to be also to be served by them as well. And so it's this it's a really beautiful ceremony, and it's like one also too that's like we only do it like for bhikkhu ordinations, it's just like we only do it one time. And so it's that's another reason why I think Lumpur does this really beautiful job of making it into a really sort of special occasion. And I like the fact we try to do them, especially the bhikkhu ordinations outdoors, kind of where the Buddha had spent most of his life. He was born outside and was enlightened outside and died outside and spent most of his life as a wanderer. When he left the home life, he spent it outdoors. So I guess I just want to just leave that for our contemplation, really how to use all the aspects of our life here, skillfully, how to raise the energy a little bit, to bringing mindfulness into all of our activities, and just realize that if there's resistance or resistance to the practice, or we don't feel like we're really getting anything out of it, that there, we might be holding it wrong, and not applying enough energy, or there might be actually other practices that are more conducive, and just so having that just that quality of investigating and paying attention to the results. So I'll leave that for our reflection this evening. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.